A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what a day in the life of a rank-and-file police officer actually looks like. Not the TV version, not the high-speed chases. The real thing. He wants to know what takes up most of their time, how often they actually make arrests, and how the experience differs between Israel, the US, and unarmed forces like the UK. It's one of those jobs everyone sees, but almost nobody understands from the inside.
The numbers are genuinely surprising. Most people assume officers are making arrests constantly. That's what the job is, right? But the data tells a completely different story. A large-scale study out of the US found that patrol officers make, on average, about one arrest every 2 weeks, not per shift. Per 2 weeks.
Your average officer is going multiple shifts without arresting anyone.
If you're working a standard rotation, 4 10-hour shifts a week, you might go 8, 10, 12 shifts between arrests. And that's an average. Some officers in quieter districts might make 2 or 3 arrests in an entire year.
Which makes the job sound less like law enforcement and more like mobile neighborhood observation.
That's actually not far off. The Bureau of Justice Statistics did a time-use survey of police officers and found that only about 10-15% of an officer's time involves any kind of crime-fighting activity at all. The rest is order maintenance, traffic, paperwork, medical calls, domestic disputes that don't result in charges, welfare checks, noise complaints. A British study from the College of Policing found that patrol officers spend roughly 80% of their shift on non-crime incidents.
The job is essentially being the person society calls when something is wrong and nobody else is coming.
That's the best one-line description I've heard, and it holds across countries. The UK, Israel, the US, the core pattern is the same. The differences are in what kinds of calls dominate, how much violence officers face, and what tools they have to respond.
Let's walk through a shift. Paint me a picture. An officer clocks in. What actually happens?
A typical patrol shift starts with roll call, which is about 15 to 20 minutes. The sergeant runs through what happened on the previous shift. Any outstanding warrants, bolos s, be on the lookout for specific vehicles or suspects, any special assignments. Then officers check out their vehicles and equipment. In the US, that includes inspecting the patrol car, making sure the radio and body camera are working, checking the shotgun or rifle if the department issues one. In Israel, officers are checking their sidearm and magazines, their ceramic vest, and often a long gun in the trunk. In the UK, it's baton, CS spray, handcuffs, body camera, and a stab vest.
Then they hit the street.
Then, for the next 8 to 12 hours, they're mostly not chasing anyone. The largest single block of time is what departments call directed patrol, which is a polite way of saying driving around, being visible. The theory is that visible police presence deters crime. The evidence for that is mixed, by the way. There's some decent research showing that focused hotspot patrols reduce crime in very specific areas for short periods, but random driving around?
It's the policing equivalent of a screensaver.
Actually, a perfect way to put it. And then the radio breaks in. And what it's usually breaking in with is not a robbery in progress. It's a noise complaint, a neighbor dispute, a shoplifting call where the suspect is long gone, a person acting erratically on a street corner, a welfare check on an elderly resident who hasn't been seen in 3 days.
The greatest hits album of minor human dysfunction.
Here's the thing. These calls eat up enormous amounts of time. A domestic disturbance, even one where nobody wants to press charges, can tie up 2 officers for 1.5 hours. You arrive, separate the parties, de-escalate, figure out what actually happened, determine if any crime occurred, file the report. Even if nothing comes of it, the paperwork still has to be done.
Paperwork being the other half of the job that nobody talks about.
It's the quiet monster. Every single call generates a report. Every traffic stop generates at least a log entry, and if a citation is issued, that's more paperwork. Use of force incidents require detailed reports that can take hours. Arrests are the worst. A single arrest can generate 3 to 5 hours of paperwork, evidence logging, and processing. Some officers have told researchers they avoid making arrests near the end of their shift because they know it means staying 4 hours late.
There's a perverse incentive to not make arrests.
And it's well documented. The arrest itself might take 10 minutes. The aftermath takes half a shift. So officers develop a kind of informal calculus. Is this worth the paperwork? Can I resolve this with a warning and a stern conversation? That's not necessarily bad policing, by the way. A lot of minor offenses are better handled with a warning. But the paperwork burden shapes behavior in ways the public doesn't see.
Let's talk Israel specifically. The prompt asked about that. What does a shift look like here?
Israeli policing has some structural differences that really shape the day. First, Israel police is a national force. There are no local police departments the way there are in the U.S. Every officer works for the same organization, which means standardized training, equipment, and procedures nationwide. Second, because of the security situation, every Israeli officer is armed, and a significant portion of their training involves terrorism response.
Even a traffic cop is expected to be the first responder to a stabbing or a shooting.
And that changes the psychological framing of the job. An Israeli officer on a routine patrol is never just on traffic duty. They're always, in the back of their mind, a counter-terrorism first responder. The training emphasizes that constantly. Every shift briefing includes security updates. There's a level of baseline alertness that's different from what you'd see in, say, suburban England.
The day-to-day calls are still noise complaints and fender benders.
Israel police published some statistics a few years back. They handle something like 4 million calls for service annually. The vast majority are traffic incidents, public order disturbances, and what they categorize as disputes. Violent crime calls are a small fraction, but the distribution changes depending on where you're stationed. An officer in Tel Aviv's southern neighborhoods sees more drug-related calls and property crime. An officer in Jerusalem's Old City deals with a complex mix of tourist issues, religious tensions, and political flashpoints. An officer in a northern development town might spend most of the day on traffic enforcement and the occasional agricultural theft. Similar pattern to the U.S., actually. Israeli patrol officers are not making arrests every shift. The average is probably a bit higher than the U.S. figure because of the security context. There are arrests related to illegal entry, security offenses, and the kinds of administrative detentions that don't have a direct U.S. parallel. But for ordinary criminal offenses, the rhythm is the same. Long stretches of nothing, punctuated by bursts of activity.
What about the unarmed policing model? The UK is the classic example. How does that reshape the job?
This is fascinating. The UK has roughly 140,000 police officers across 43 territorial forces, and the vast majority are unarmed. Only about 6% are authorized firearms officers. That changes the dynamic in ways that are both obvious and subtle. The obvious one, a UK officer approaching a suspicious situation knows they cannot fall back on lethal force. They have to rely on communication, de-escalation, and physical restraint techniques. The training emphasizes this heavily. UK police receive extensive training in conflict resolution and verbal de-escalation that goes well beyond what most US academies provide.
Which probably feeds back into how they're perceived by the public.
There's a well-documented difference in the interaction style. UK officers tend to approach people with a more conversational, less command presence posture. Not because they're inherently friendlier people, but because the toolset demands it. When you don't have a gun on your hip, you can't afford to escalate a situation. You have to talk it down.
The absence of a weapon shapes the entire philosophy of the encounter.
And it shapes the kinds of outcomes, too. UK police fatal shootings are vanishingly rare, typically 1 to 3 per year across the entire country. The US, by comparison, sees around 1,000. Now, part of that is the difference in gun violence rates in the general population. The U.S. has vastly more armed civilians, which means officers face a fundamentally different threat profile. You can't just compare the numbers directly and draw simple conclusions, but the training philosophy difference is real and significant.
What does a UK officer's shift actually look like, hour by hour?
Similar structure to what we described, roll call, equipment check, patrol. But the call mix is different. UK officers spend a huge amount of time on what they call public protection, mental health calls, missing persons, safeguarding vulnerable adults and children. A major report from Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary found that mental health-related calls have become one of the single largest demands on police time, in part because mental health services have been cut back and police have become the default responders.
They're doing the work of a social safety net that isn't there.
They'll tell you that openly. There was a remarkable quote from a chief constable a few years ago. She said, "The police have become the service of first and last resort. When there's nobody else to call, you call the police." And that's true everywhere, but it's especially pronounced in the UK because of how the social service landscape has changed.
Let's talk about the moments that do involve danger. How often does the average officer actually face a violent threat?
Depends heavily on where they work. A 2021 Pew survey of U.S. officers found that about 30% said they had been physically attacked at some point in their career. But that's over an entire career. On a per-shift basis, violent encounters are rare for most officers. The Bureau of Justice Statistics data shows that only about 1-2% of all police citizen contacts involve any use of force by the officer, and the rate at which officers are injured is similarly low.
The job is mostly boring, occasionally terrifying, and frequently sad.
That's the three-word summary, yes. And the sad part is under discussed. Officers spend a lot of time with people on the worst day of their lives. Parents who've lost a child, victims of domestic violence, people in the middle of a mental health crisis, families being evicted. The accumulated psychological toll is enormous. PTSD rates among police officers are estimated at somewhere between 15 and 30%, which is several times the general population rate.
Yet the public image of the job is shaped almost entirely by the rare moments of high drama.
That's the Hollywood problem. Police procedurals show officers solving complex cases in 44 minutes, making dramatic arrests, engaging in gunfights. The reality is that most officers will never fire their weapon outside of training. Most will never be in a high-speed pursuit. Most will spend 30 years on the job and retire having made fewer arrests than a TV detective makes in a single season.
Which creates a weird gap between what recruits expect and what they get.
There's actually research on this. A study of police academy recruits found that their expectations of the job were wildly skewed toward the action-oriented crime-fighting model. By the end of their first year on patrol, most had substantially recalibrated. The ones who couldn't recalibrate tended to burn out or leave. The ones who stayed were the ones who found satisfaction in the quieter parts of the job, helping people, solving small problems, being a stabilizing presence.
Successful policing is really about being comfortable with low-grade chaos and occasional boredom.
Being able to shift gears instantly when the boredom breaks. That's the hard part. You're driving around for 3 hours, nothing happening, and then suddenly you're in a situation that requires split-second judgment with life-or-death stakes. The cognitive whiplash is intense, and it's one of the things training tries hardest to prepare officers for. Whether it succeeds is another question.
You mentioned earlier that Israeli officers carry a different psychological load because of the security context. Let's dig into that. What does that actually look like in practice?
Israeli police training is heavily influenced by the military. Many officers did combat service before joining the force. The academy emphasizes immediate action drills for terrorist attacks, what to do when you hear gunfire, how to approach a scene with an active threat, how to coordinate with arriving units. There's a concept called Kaitet Konanet mindset, the readiness squad mentality, that carries over.
Which means an Israeli officer is never fully off duty, mentally.
And in some cases, not just mentally. Israeli police officers are required to carry their service weapons even when off duty in many circumstances. They're expected to intervene if they encounter a terrorist attack while off the clock. That's a fundamentally different social contract than what exists in the UK, where off-duty officers are essentially civilians and are not expected to carry weapons or intervene in anything beyond calling 999.
The US is somewhere in the middle, I'd guess. Off-duty officers often carry, but the expectation to intervene varies.
US departments vary enormously. Some have policies requiring off-duty officers to carry and intervene. Others discourage it for liability reasons. There's no national standard. The U.S. has roughly 18,000 separate law enforcement agencies, and they all have their own policies, their own training standards, their own cultures. That fragmentation is one of the things that makes American policing so hard to generalize about.
Which brings us to attention the prompt is getting at. How much of the job is universal, and how much is shaped by local context?
The universal parts are the ones that don't make it into the news. Talking to people. De-escalating arguments. Testifying in court on days off. The parts that are specific to context are things like, how much danger am I in? What tools do I have? What does the community expect of me? What happens if I make a mistake?
Let's talk about that last one. Accountability structures differ wildly across these three contexts.
They really do. In the UK, the Independent Office for Police Conduct investigates serious incidents and complaints. Body camera footage is routinely reviewed. There's a relatively robust system, though it has its critics. In Israel, the Police Internal Investigations Department, Machash, handles complaints, but it's been criticized for being slow and under-resourced. In the US, oversight is a patchwork. Some cities have strong civilian review boards, others have essentially nothing. And qualified immunity, which doesn't have a direct equivalent in the other systems, creates a legal landscape that's uniquely American.
Qualified immunity being the doctrine that shields officers from civil lawsuits unless they violated clearly established law.
And the practical effect is that it's quite difficult to hold individual officers financially accountable for misconduct in the U.S. That shapes behavior, shapes training, shapes the relationship between police and the communities they serve. It's one of those structural features that's invisible to most people but has enormous downstream effects.
What about the physical toll? We talked about the psychological side, but what does a shift do to the body?
It's brutal in ways that aren't obvious. Sitting in a patrol car for hours is terrible for your back and circulation. The constant low-grade stress elevates cortisol. Shift work disrupts sleep. Most departments rotate shifts, so officers might work days 1 week, nights the next, and their circadian rhythms never stabilize. There's a well-documented correlation between police work and cardiovascular disease. Officers have higher rates of hypertension, heart attacks, and stroke than the general population, even after controlling for other factors.
The eating habits don't help. Patrol officers are famously dependent on whatever food is available at odd hours.
Gas station meals, fast food, coffee by the gallon, it's not a recipe for longevity. There's a reason the average police retirement age is relatively low. Many departments allow retirement after 20 or 25 years, and it's not just about pension structures. The body can't sustain the lifestyle much longer than that.
We've painted a picture of a job that's mostly mundane, physically punishing, psychologically draining, occasionally dangerous, and structured by paperwork. Why would anyone do it?
That's the question, isn't it? And the answer, from talking to officers and reading the research, tends to cluster around a few things. One is a genuine desire to help people, cliché but real. Two is the variety. No two shifts are exactly the same, and for people who hate desk jobs, that's appealing. Three is the camaraderie. Police units tend to form tight bonds, and that social connection is a powerful retention force. Four is the pension and benefits, which in many departments are quite good.
There's probably a subset who enjoy the authority.
And that subset causes disproportionate problems. But they're a minority. Most officers, in my reading, are people who wanted a job that mattered, that wasn't behind a desk, and that provided a stable middle-class life. And they got what they signed up for, more or less. They just didn't realize how much of it would be paperwork and noise complaints.
Let's circle back to arrests one more time. The prompt was specifically curious about this. What's the most surprising thing about arrest patterns?
First, arrests are heavily concentrated among a small number of officers. In most departments, something like 10 to 15% of officers account for half or more of all arrests. The majority of officers make very few. So the average of one arrest every 2 weeks is misleading. It's actually a distribution where most officers are below the average and a few are way above it.
Which probably says something about those high arrest officers. Either they're unusually proactive, or they're assigned to the busiest sectors, or there's something else going on.
Or all of the above. There's research suggesting that a small number of officers are what criminologists call rate makers. They produce a disproportionate share of stops, citations, and arrests. And their behavior shapes the aggregate statistics in ways that can distort public understanding.
The second surprising thing?
The second is that most arrests are for relatively minor offenses. In the U.S., the single largest arrest category is drug possession, followed by simple assault, followed by theft. Violent felonies make up a small fraction of total arrests. In the U.K., the pattern is similar. The largest categories are theft, drug offenses, and public order violations. In Israel, there's an additional category of security-related arrests that doesn't have a direct parallel, but for ordinary crime, the pattern holds.
The image of the detective cracking a murder case is not just rare, it's a completely different job from what patrol officers do.
Detectives and patrol officers live in different worlds. Detectives work cases over weeks or months. They're not taking radio calls. They're not doing traffic stops. They're not responding to noise complaints. The patrol officer is the general practitioner of policing. They deal with whatever walks through the door. The detective is the specialist, and the two roles have very different daily rhythms.
One more thing I want to touch on, the unarmed model. You mentioned the UK. Are there other examples worth noting?
New Zealand, Norway, Iceland, Ireland. Several countries have predominantly unarmed police forces. The pattern is fairly consistent. Lower rates of fatal police shootings, different training emphasis, different public interaction style. But it's important not to romanticize this. These countries also have much lower rates of civilian gun ownership and much lower rates of violent crime overall. You can't just drop an unarmed police force into a heavily armed society and expect the same outcomes.
The model travels poorly.
It's deeply context-dependent. The British model works in Britain because of a specific legal, cultural, and social environment. It's not a plug-and-play solution for countries with different conditions. That said, there are lessons that do travel. The emphasis on de-escalation training, the communication-first approach, the recognition that most police work is social work. Those insights are portable even if the specific policy of being unarmed is not.
What would a shift in an unarmed force look like compared to what we've described?
Structurally similar. Roll call, patrol, calls for service, paperwork. But the texture of the interactions is different. A UK officer approaching a potentially volatile situation is thinking about positioning, exit routes, backup, and verbal strategies. A US officer is thinking about all of those things plus the possibility that the person they're approaching has a firearm. That additional layer of threat assessment changes the entire calculus of every encounter.
Which must be exhausting in its own way.
Hypervigilance is exhausting regardless of whether you're armed or unarmed. But the specific flavor of hypervigilance differs. In the US, officers are trained to watch hands constantly. Hands are what kill you. In the UK, officers are watching for different things. Body language, verbal cues, signs of escalating agitation. The threat profile is different, so the attention profile is different.
Let's bring this back to the rank and file officer the prompt asked about. Someone who started on foot patrol. What's their career arc?
Typically, you start on patrol. That's the entry point for almost everyone. In most departments, you spend at least 2 to 5 years on patrol before you can apply for specialized units. Detectives, traffic, K-9, SWAT, community policing. Some officers stay on patrol their entire careers by choice. Others use it as a stepping stone. But patrol is the foundation. It's where you learn to read situations, to talk to people, to make quick decisions with incomplete information.
Foot patrol specifically. That's increasingly rare, isn't it?
Most patrol is vehicle-based now for efficiency and coverage reasons. Foot patrol is more common in dense urban areas, shopping districts, and specifically in community policing initiatives. There's some evidence that foot patrol builds better community relationships than vehicle patrol. It's harder to have a conversation through a car window. But it's more expensive in terms of officer time per area covered, so it tends to be the exception rather than the rule.
The officer on foot is a very different presence than the officer in a car.
The car is a barrier, physical and psychological. An officer on foot is accessible in a way that an officer in a patrol car simply isn't. They can stop and talk. They notice different things, smells, sounds, the mood of a street. There's a reason community policing advocates push for foot patrol despite the efficiency arguments against it.
All right, let's try to synthesize this. If someone asked you to describe a typical shift in one paragraph, what would you say?
You arrive, you get briefed, you check your gear, you go out. You spend most of the shift driving or walking, being visible, waiting for the radio to crackle. When it does, it's usually something mundane. A dispute, a traffic incident, a person in distress. You talk to people, you write things down. Occasionally something dangerous happens, and you shift into a completely different mode. You finish your shift, you write more reports, you go home. Most days you don't arrest anyone. Most days you don't draw your weapon. Most days, the job is about presence and patience more than action.
Then you do it again tomorrow.
Then you do it again tomorrow, for 20 or 30 years.
There's something almost monastic about that. The repetition, the discipline, the bearing of other people's burdens.
I think that's actually a useful frame. The job has a contemplative dimension that nobody talks about. You spend hours alone in a car or walking a beat with your own thoughts. You see human nature at its worst and occasionally at its best. You develop a kind of weary wisdom about how people behave under stress. It's not the image of policing we're sold, but it's the reality.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1904, the mathematician Duncan Maclaren, working from a croft on the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, rediscovered a lost optical theorem originally described by Ibn al-Hatham in the 11th century, namely, that a perfectly spherical mirror produces a caustic curve, not a point focus, when reflecting off-axis light. Maclaren published it in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Edinburgh under the title On the Non-Punctiform Convergence of Spherical Reflectors, unaware that Ibn al-Haytham had described the same phenomenon in his Book of Optics 800 years earlier.
Right. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got a question that needs answering, send it our way. We'll be here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.